tree trunks, holding their breath. There stood the trolls, three large trolls. One was stooping, and the other two stood staring at him. Strider walked forward unconcernedly.
"Get up, old stone," he said, and broke his stick upon the stooping troll.
Nothing happened. There was a gasp of astonishment from the hobbits, and then even Frodo laughed.
"Well," he said, "we're forgetting our family history. These must be the very three that were caught by Gandalf, quarrelling over the right way to cook 13 dwarves and one hobbit."
"I had no idea we were anywhere near the place," said Pippin.
He knew the story well. Bilbo and Frodo had told it often, but as a matter of fact, he'd never more than half believed it. Even now he looked at the stone trolls with suspicion, wondering if some magic might not suddenly bring them to life again.
"You are forgetting not only your family history, but all you ever knew about trolls," said Strider. "It's broad daylight with a bright sun, and yet you come back trying to scare me with a tale of live trolls waiting for us in this glade. In any case, you might have noticed that one of them has an old bird's nest behind his ear. That would be a most unusual ornament for a live troll."
They all laughed. Frodo felt his spirits reviving. The reminder of Bilbo's first successful adventure was heartening. The sun, too, was warm and comforting, and the mist before his eyes seemed to be lifting a little. They rested for some time in the glade, and took their midday meal right under the shadow of the troll's large legs.
"Won't somebody give us a bit of a song while the sun is high?" said Merry, when they'd finished. "We haven't had a song or a tale for days."
"Not since Weathertop," said Frodo. The others looked at him.
"Don't worry about me," he added. "I feel much better, but I don't think I could sing. Perhaps Sam could dig something out of his memory."
"Come on, Sam," said Merry. "There's more stored in your head than you let on about."
"I don't know about that," said Sam. "But how would this suit? It ain't what I call proper poetry, if you understand me. Just a bit of nonsense. But these old images here brought it to my mind."
Standing up, with his hands behind his back, as if he was at school, he began to sing to an old tune.
"Troll sat alone on his seat of stone, and munched and mumbled bare old bone. For many a year he had gnawed it near, for meat was hard to come by. Done by, gum by, in a cave in the hills he dwelt alone, and meat was hard to come by. Up came Tom with his big boots on. Said he to Troll, 'Pray, what is yon? For it looks like the shin of mine uncle Tim, as should be a lion in graveyard, caveyard, paveyard. This many a year has Tim been gone, and I thought he was lion in graveyard. My lad,' says Troll, 'this bone I stole, but what be bones that lie in a hole? Thine uncle was dead as a lump of lead, afore I found his shin bone. Tin bone, thin bone, he can spare a share for a poor old troll, for he don't need his shin bone.' Said Tom, 'I don't see why the likes of thee, without axe and leave, should go making free with the shank or the shin of my father's kin. So hand the old bone over. Rover, trover, though dead he be, it belongs to he. So hand the old bone over. For a couple of pins,' says Troll, and grins, 'I'd eat thee too, and gnaw thy shins. A bit of fresh meat will go down sweet. I'll try my teeth on thee now. He now, see now, I'm tired of gnawing old bones and skins. I've a mind to dine on thee now.' But just as he thought his dinner was caught, he found his hands had hold of naught, for before he could mind, Tom slipped behind and gave him the boot to learn him.
Warn him, darn him, a bump of the boot on the seat, Tom thought, would be the way to learn him. But harder than stone is the flesh and bone of a troll that sits in the hills alone. As well set your boot to the mountain's root, for the seat of a troll don't feel it. Peel it, heel it. Old Troll laughed when he heard Tom groan, and he knew his toes could feel it. Tom's leg is game since home he came, and his bootless foot is lasting lame. But Troll don't care, and he's still there with the bone he boned from its owner. Donor, boner. Troll's old seat is still the same, and the bony bone from its owner.
Well, that's a warning to us all, laughed Mary. It's as well you used a stick and not your hand, Strider.
Where did you come by that, Sam? Asked Pippin.
I've never heard those words before.
Sam muttered something inaudible.
It's out of his own head, of course, said Frodo. I'm learning a lot about Sam Gamgee on this journey. First he was a conspirator, now he's a jester. He'll end up by becoming a wizard, or a warrior.
I hope not, said Sam. I don't want to be neither.
In the afternoon they went on down the woods. They were probably following the very track that Gandalf, Bilbo and the dwarves had used many years before. After a few miles, they came out on the top of a high bank above the road. At this point, the road had left the Horwell far behind in its narrow valley, and now clung close to the feet of the hills, rolling and winding eastward among the woods and heather-covered slopes towards the fords and the mountains. Not far down the bank, Strider pointed out a stone in the grass. On it, roughly cut and now much weathered, could still be seen dwarf runes and secret marks.
There, said Mary, that must be the stone that marked the place where the troll's gold was hidden. How much is left of Bilbo's share, I wonder, Frodo?
Frodo looked at the stone and wished that Bilbo had brought home no treasure more perilous nor less easy to part with.
None at all, he said. Bilbo gave it all away.
He told me he didn't feel it was really his, as it came from robbers. The road lay quiet under the long shadows of early evening. There was no sign of any other travellers to be seen. As there was now no other possible course for them to take, they climbed down the bank and, turning left, went off as fast as they could. Soon a shoulder of the hills cut off the light of the fast westering sun. A cold wind flowed down to meet them from the mountains ahead. They were beginning to look out for a place off the road where they could camp for the night, when they heard a sound that brought sudden fear back into their hearts, the noise of hoofs behind them. They looked back, but they couldn't see far because of the many windings and rollings of the road. As quickly as they could, they scrambled off the beaten way and up into the deep heather and bilberry brushwood on the slopes above until they came to a small patch of thick-growing hazels. As they peered out from among the bushes, they could see the road, faint and grey in the failing light, some 30 feet below them. The sound of hoofs grew nearer. They were going fast, with a light clippity-clippity-clip. Then faintly, as if it was blown away from them by the breeze, they seemed to catch a dim ringing as of small bells tinkling.
"That doesn't sound like a Black Rider's horse," said Frodo, listening intently.
The other hobbits agreed hopefully that it did not, but they all remained full of suspicion. They'd been in fear of pursuit for so long that any sound from behind seemed ominous and unfriendly. But Strider was now leaning forward, stooped to the ground, with a hand to his ear and a look of joy on his face. The light faded, and the leaves on the bushes rustled softly. Clearer and nearer now the bells jingled, and clippity-clip came the quick trotting feet. Suddenly into view below came a white horse, gleaming in the shadows, running swiftly. In the dusk its headstall flickered and flashed, as if it were studded with gems like living stars.
The rider's cloak streamed behind him, and his hood was thrown back. His golden hair flowed, shimmering in the wind of his speed. To Frodo it appeared that a white light was shining through the form and raiment of the rider, as if through a thin veil. Strider sprang from hiding and dashed down towards the road, leaping with a cry through the heather. But even before he had moved or called, the rider had reined in his horse and halted, looking up towards the thicket where they stood. When he saw Strider, he dismounted and ran to meet him, calling out,
"Ay na verdui Dunadan, my Govanan!"
His speech and clear, ringing voice left no doubt in their hearts. The rider was of the elven folk. No others that dwelt in the wide world had voices so fair to hear. But there seemed to be a note of haste or fear in his call, and they saw that he was now speaking quickly and urgently to Strider. Soon Strider beckoned to them, and the hobbits left the bushes and hurried down to the road.
"This is Glorfindel, who dwells in the house of Elrond," said Strider.
"Hail and well met at last," said the elf lord to Frodo. "I was sent from Rivendell to look for you. We feared that you were in danger upon the road."
"Then Gandalf has reached Rivendell?" cried Frodo joyfully.
"No, he had not when I departed, but that was 9 days ago," answered Glorfindel. "Elrond received news that troubled him. Some of my kindred, journeying in your land beyond the Barrandwin, which you call the Brandywine River, learned that things were amiss, and sent messages as swiftly as they could. They said that the Nine were abroad, and that you were astray, bearing a great burden without guidance, for Gandalf had not returned. There are few, even in Rivendell, that can ride openly against the Nine, but such as there were, Elrond sent out north, west, and south. It was thought that you might turn far aside to avoid pursuit, and become lost in the wilderness. It was my lot to take the road, and I came to the bridge of Mithaethel, and left a token there, nigh on 7 days ago. Three of the servants of Sauron were upon the bridge, but they withdrew, and I pursued them westward. I came also upon two others, but they turned away southward. Since then I've searched for your trail. 2 days ago I found it, and followed it over the bridge, and today I marked where you descended from the hills again. But come, there is no time for further news. Since you are here, we must risk the peril of the road and go. There are five behind us, and when they find your trail upon the road, they will ride after us like the wind. And they are not all. Where the other four may be, I do not know. I fear that we may find the ford is already held against us." While Glorfindel was speaking, the shades of evening deepened. Frodo felt a great weariness come over him. Ever since the sun began to sink, the mist before his eyes had darkened, and he felt that a shadow was coming between him and the faces of his friends. Now pain assailed him, and he felt cold. He swayed, clutching at Sam's arm.
"My master is sick and wounded," said Sam angrily. "He can't go on riding after nightfall. He needs rest."
Glorfindel caught Frodo as he sank to the ground, and taking him gently in his arms, he looked in his face with grave anxiety. Briefly, Strider told of the attack on their camp under Weathertop, and of the deadly knife. He drew out the hilt, which he had kept, and handed it to the elf. Glorfindel shuddered as he took it, but he looked intently at it. "There are evil things written on this hilt," he said, "though maybe your eyes cannot see them. Keep it, Aragorn, till we reach the house of Elrond, but be wary, and handle it as little as you may. Alas, the wounds of this weapon are beyond my skill to heal. I will do what I can, but all the more do I urge you now to go on without rest." He searched the wound on Frodo's shoulder with his fingers, and his face grew graver, as if what he learned disquieted him. But Frodo felt the chill lessen in his side and arm. A little warmth crept down from his shoulder to his hand, and the pain grew easier. The dusk of evening seemed to grow lighter about him, as if a cloud had been withdrawn. He saw his friends' faces more clearly again, and a measure of new hope and strength returned.
"You shall ride my horse," said Glorfindel. "I will shorten the stirrups up to the saddle skirts, and you must sit as tight as you can.
but you need not fear. My horse will not let any rider fall that I command him to bear. His pace is light and smooth, and if danger presses too near, he will bear you away with a speed that even the black steeds of the enemy cannot rival." "No, he will not," said Frodo. "I shall not ride him, if I am to be carried off to Rivendell or anywhere else, leaving my friends behind in danger."
Glorfindel smiled. "I doubt very much," he said, "if your friends would be in danger if you were not with them. The pursuit would follow you and leave us in peace, I think. It is you, Frodo, and that which you bear that brings us all in peril." To that Frodo had no answer, and he was persuaded to mount Glorfindel's white horse. The pony was laden instead with a great part of the others' burdens, so that they now marched lighter, and for a time made good speed. But the hobbits began to find it hard to keep up with the swift, tireless feet of the elf. On he led them, into the mouth of darkness, and still on under the deep clouded night. There was neither star nor moon. Not until the grey of dawn did he allow them to halt. Pippin, Merry, and Sam were by that time nearly asleep on their stumbling legs, and even Strider seemed by the sag of his shoulders to be weary. Frodo sat upon the horse in a dark dream. They cast themselves down in the heather a few yards from the roadside and fell asleep immediately. They seemed hardly to have closed their eyes when Glorfindel, who had set himself to watch while they slept, awoke them again. The sun had now climbed far into the morning, and the clouds and mists of the night were gone. "Drink this," said Glorfindel to them, pouring for each in turn a little liquor from his silver-studded flask of leather. It was clear as spring water and had no taste, and it did not feel either cool or warm in the mouth, but strength and vigour seemed to flow into all their limbs as they drank it. Eaten after that draught, the stale bread and dried fruit, which was now all they had left, seemed to satisfy their hunger better than many a good breakfast in the Shire had done. They had rested rather less than 5 hours when they took to the road again. Glorfindel still urged them on, and only allowed 2 brief halts during the day's march. In this way they covered almost 20 miles before nightfall, and came to a point where the road bent right and ran down towards the bottom of the valley, now making straight for the Bruinen. So far there had been no sign or sound of pursuit that the hobbits could see or hear, but often Glorfindel would halt and listen for a moment if they lagged behind, and a look of anxiety clouded his face. Once or twice he spoke to Strider in the elf tongue. But however anxious their guides might be, it was plain that the hobbits could go no further that night. They were stumbling along, dizzy with weariness, and unable to think of anything but their feet and legs. Frodo's pain had redoubled, and during the day things about him faded to shadows of ghostly grey. He almost welcomed the coming of night, for then the world seemed less pale and empty. The hobbits were still weary when they set out again early next morning. There were many miles yet to go between them and the ford, and they hobbled forward at the best pace they could manage. "Our peril will be greatest just ere we reach the river," said Glorfindel, "for my heart warns me that the pursuit is now swift behind us, and other danger may be waiting by the ford." The road was still running steadily downhill, and there was now in places much grass at either side, in which the hobbits walked when they could to ease their tired feet. In the late afternoon they came to a place where the road went suddenly under the dark shadow of tall pine trees, and then plunged into a deep cutting with steep, moist walls of red stone. Echoes ran along as they hurried forward, and there seemed to be a sound of many footfalls following their own. All at once, as if through a gate of light, the road ran out again from the end of the tunnel into the open. There, at the bottom of a sharp incline, they saw before them a long, flat mile, and beyond that the ford of Rivendell. On the further side was a steep brown bank, threaded by a winding path, and behind that the tall mountains climbed, shoulder above shoulder, and peak beyond peak, into the fading sky. There was still an echo as of following feet in the cutting behind them,
a rushing noise as if a wind were rising and pouring through the branches of the pines. One moment Glorfindel turned and listened, then he sprang forward with a